About 10 weeks ago or so, we read through the story of Balaam and Balak in Numbers 22 to 24. And it reminded me of an exhortational article I read some years ago now by Brother Ken Somerville. I remember being impressed with it and scanning it into my computer with a view to using it if we suddenly found ourselves without a speaker. I have used the idea very substantially in my exhortation this morning. And there are additions, there are a few alterations, and occasionally the odd omission. Any shortcomings are mine alone. Please tell me about it later. Balak was king of Moab. We get an inkling of his extreme alarm when he hears of Israel's defeat of the Amorites and sees them encamped on the east side of Jordan, about level with Jericho. He knows they have come from Egypt. He describes them as covering the land like a locust swarm, and fears they will eat up the grass of the land like a herd of oxen. Fearing they are too strong an army for him to contend with, he enlists the support of the local Midianites and sends off an urgent message to the northernmost border of his kingdom at Pethor, some 400 miles north, to a man known for his ability in the arts of divination, that is, contact with the gods, and his name is Balaam. He was to be paid for his services. Now Pethor, if you look at a map, is, we reckon, on the banks of the Euphrates, in the region called Padan Aram, which is where Abraham came from about 450 years before. He comes south into the Promised Land. And possibly Balaam knew from history something of the God of Abraham, and classed him as one of the gods of the surrounding lands. He would listen with interest to the message of Balak and possibly put two and two together and make four. Besides, he was always interested in charging the appropriate fee for a consultation. And by this time, the Lord had established contact with him and was to use him in his own way, whatever Balaam felt inclined to do himself. In answer to his first request to the Lord, he was told, "Go not with the ambassadors, and don't curse Israel, for they are blessed." And the Moabite embassage returned to Balak, unsuccessful, tails between their legs. And Balak was not to be put off, and he sent a higher level embassage with the message that Balaam would be awarded special honour and status and paid handsomely. And again Balaam consulted the Lord, and this time the instruction was, "If the men come to call you in the morning, go with them." But further instructions were to be very strictly followed. Whether Balaam actually waited for the embassage to appear the following morning, we are not told. But you could infer by the time that they did, that Balaam had already been up early, very early, saddled his ass, packed his bags, and so off they went. The journey south was interrupted three times, with three miracles. The ass saw the angel of the Lord, and when the ass saw God's angel with drawn sword in his hand, she turned off the pathway into a field, and Balaam struck her to turn her back onto the path. And again the ass saw the armed angel at a point where the path led between two vineyard walls, and she sheered away against one of the walls, crushing Balaam's foot, a painful experience. He struck her again to teach her a lesson for such strange, careless behaviour. And finally, in a narrow place, she could see no way of avoiding the angel, and she collapsed to the ground. And Balaam lost his cool entirely and started to beat her with his staff. And then the second miracle happened. Never since Eden had an animal spoken, and never before Balaam's time had a donkey spoken, and never again afterwards. And how important was this message from the Lord through the donkey? She asks Balaam, "What have I done unto thee, that thou hast smitten me these three times?" And by now, Balaam was so furious, it does not seem to register that the donkey has spoken. A warning exhortation is for us in Proverbs chapter 22. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go, lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. And Balaam replies, "Because thou hast mocked me, I would there were a sword in my hand, for now would I kill thee." And the ass said unto Balaam, "Am not I thine ass, upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day? Was I ever wont to do so unto thee?" And perhaps realizing the truth of what the animal has spoken, and surely with a degree less vehemence, Balaam answers, "No." Then the third, the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And the Lord said unto him, "Wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee, because thy way is perverse before me. And the ass saw me, and turned from me these three times. Unless she had turned from me, surely now I also had slain thee, and saved her alive." When donkeys talk, it may pay to listen. Things are not always as they appear. Who would have thought to give anyone that advice? And yet, in hindsight, we all know now what Balaam learned then. Extremely important advice can come from a donkey. And that was a unique incident in the history of the world, and has never happened before or since, has it? And you and I are not likely to meet a talking donkey. Or are we? The broader subject, of which Balaam's ass is just a specific example, is the matter of God communicating with us. God has not always found us to be open, a ready audience for his advice. He has used every method imaginable, and some practically unimaginable methods, to communicate with us. He has a reputation among us for working in mysterious ways. When he might have been expected in an earthquake, he spoke in a still small voice. And when he sent his son to lead us back to him and to become king of the world, he did so in a way devoid of all pomp and circumstances. Actually, he sent him to us in circumstances of poverty and relative obscurity. The baby, destined to be king, was born in a stable and raised in a poor, out-of-the-way village. Just how difficult it is to reach us may be seen in Jesus' own words. "Whereunto then shall I liken the men of this generation? And to what are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling one to another and saying, 'We have piped unto you, and you have not danced. We have mourned to you, and you have not wept.'" In other words, nothing seems to work. And God has been persistent. In fact, if he were not God, he might even be accused of nagging. The pages of the Bible are full of God's efforts to reach us.
Howbeit, I sent unto you all my prophets, rising early and sending them, saying, O, do not this abominable thing that I hate. Finally, he sent his son, and we know how we reacted to that. Many ordinary people agreed to murder him. But not everyone in Jerusalem was a murderer, and we may think that had we lived then, we would have been of that small number who listened to Jesus with open minds and open hearts. Even if we share the same nature as those who rejected him, we need not share the same fate. Nevertheless, we are susceptible to the same human tendency, refusing to listen, especially to what we do not want to hear. Now, what about the donkeys that God sends to us? At first, Balaam's donkey said nothing. It just stopped. It turned off the way and finally refused to move forward. And we can certainly understand how this would have been very frustrating. When the car won't start, and it won't work out, we can't work out what's wrong. We can understand how Balaam must have felt, beating one's donkey, like slamming down the bonnet of the car in a fit of temper. It almost makes sense. Should he have understood the donkey's actions as a warning from God not to proceed? Had not the angel just told him the night before to rise up and go with Balak's men this morning? And then, on a previous occasion, God had told Balaam, "Thou shalt not go with them." On the surface, it does seem as though Balaam was getting some mixed signals. But when we ask the next question, we begin to understand Balaam's motive in this sad story, and we may be on the way to self-examination. The question is, having received a clear, unequivocal message from God that he should not go with Balak's men to curse Israel, why did Balaam ask the same question again? Was it because he did not like the first answer? Was it because deep down Balaam really wanted to do what God did not want him to do? Like me, have you ever wanted to do something so much that you found asking one person after another for advice? Finally, you found someone who agreed with you. And then, of course, you followed his advice. And of course, we do not have to speculate about what was motivating Balaam. He was, we are told in the New Testament, greedy, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, as Peter puts it in his second letter, which we read a week ago. He wanted more than he already had. He wanted what Balak was offering. He was covetous. In effect, he worshipped the idol of money. As Paul puts it in his letter to the Colossians, covetousness, which is idolatry. We might have read in Proverbs recently, a good name is better to be chosen than great riches, and loving favour rather than silver and gold. And Balaam had his eye on the wages, not on the good name. So what is the best way to reach us, for the Lord to reach us? Whether we covet what we should not have, or want to do what we should not do, or persist in a self-destructive habit, how can God reach us to help us change? How can anyone reach us? Are we reachable? Jesus' words, "We have piped unto you, and you have not danced. We mourn to you, and you have not wept," suggests that God has tried, is trying, and will continue to try every way possible to break through our natural resistance and reach us. There are three principal ways in which God speaks to us, though he's not limited to this, as we know. There's the scriptures, the word of God, there is answered prayer, and there is the brotherhood. The Bible is the clearest voice because its words are fixed in print and act as a reliable guide to which we can refer and which we can discuss with others. We can reason logically about its message. We can consider all the evidence it provides. In doing so, we may overcome our personal biases and tendencies and get closer to what God is actually saying to us. Answered prayer is extremely powerful to the one whose prayer has been answered, but another person might feel it is a bit too subjective to be a useful indicator in his or her own life. Now we come to the central point of this exhortation. God may speak to us through our brothers and sisters. Yes, through our friends, our wives and husbands, or through our children. We can agree wholeheartedly when Jesus speaks critically to his disciples, and when the New Testament writers write critically to first century ecclesias, but we have great difficulty when someone takes us aside and criticizes our actions. We have read already this morning the advice of the Lord Jesus Christ speaking critically to some of those first century ecclesias. The idea that God might be speaking to us through our brother or sister, or wife or husband, is the furthest thing from our minds when we're being criticised. We jump so quickly into our knee-jerk defensive reactions. In fact, we may respond just like Balaam did to beating the messenger. Sometimes we kill the messenger with a hot, angry outburst. Who are you to tell me anything? Or sometimes we kill the messenger with a cool, calculating, carefully worded argument composed hours or days later, a sort of lawyer's brief, sprinkled with sarcasm and veiled attacks upon our opponent. And the question still remains, how can we be reached? And if we are honest, we may say, well, please don't criticise me in front of others. Or, don't criticise me when I've just come home from a hard day at the office. Or, please wait until I'm feeling better. The question remains, how can you be reached? Not, how should you not be reached? And the fact must be faced. Some of us, many of us, find it just about impossible to receive any constructive criticism whatsoever. That should tell us something about ourselves. Perhaps, after careful, honest consideration, we may come up with the way that we would find the least upsetting. There will be almost no way to avoid all upset, and in the self-examination, we may realise two things. First of all, that the problem is ours, that we have erected too many barriers, too many defence mechanisms around ourselves, and secondly, that the next time we are criticised, we should work just that much harder to soften our hearts and open our minds and really listen to our critic. This is not to suggest that 100% of all criticism is valid, nor that one should suspend one's own judgment and be led here and there by every piece of advice one receives. But we should realise that most criticism has something of benefit in it. Sometimes we act as if the world revolves around us. In fact, very few people stay up late at night trying to think of something to say just to upset us. When criticism does come, most likely the messenger has a point, whether well articulated or not, whether he or she is the best to make it or not, and we do well to take heed. Even if the critic is a donkey, he or she may well be on the way, one way or another. There may be merit in his message or her message. And God may be using him or her to reach you and me when all other better means have failed. Besides, what does it hurt to listen patiently and then think about it? So far, we've thought about giving criticism. How about receiving criticism? Jesus says it is more blessed to give than to receive. But criticism may be one of the few things that is not more blessed to give than to receive. Still, sometimes we do have the obligation to be critical, not overly much, but it must be done. Remember the many beams in our own eyes. They should affect our attitude, for that alone should not be used to avoid our reasonable duties. As an Old Testament principle in Leviticus 19, thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt surely rebuke thy neighbour and not allow sin upon him. Common sense tells us that we should warn someone when we see him or her taking a dangerous turning. Driving once, I turned down a one-way street. It was in Gisborough. I was only going one way, but it was the wrong way. A man waved me down and warned me that traffic wardens were currently on the lookout at the farther end of the road. Gratefully, I took his advice and turned round. But of course, that was easy advice to take, and it contained no personal criticism. I had no good reason to go down that particular street. I just failed to notice the no-entry signs. But the possibility of ending up in the local magistrate's court was real and fairly certain. I was not being told to change the direction of my life, away from a goal into which I had made large investments of time, money, and emotion. How much more important is it to warn our brother or sister that the road they are travelling down may lead into spiritual danger, or even spiritual death? Better to speak up and be thought an ass for a while than to feel far longer the guilt of knowing that they should have said that you should have said something, but said nothing simply because it was easier. As James wrote, the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. How do other versions translate the phrase easy to be entreated? Here's a few to ponder. Be open to reason, friendly, willing to yield, thinks about others, be submissive. As we share the bread and wine this morning, let's remember they are symbolic of the oneness we should have in our Saviour, and resolve, as James counseled, to listen carefully and to bridle our tongues.